time to close on it.
All right. So let's get started over here. We're holding on Mem Alephoma Bay, two lines from the bottom.
Mem Alephoma Bay. Okay, so we're in the middle of discussing. We started with Machloikas Rav Yechanan and Rish Lakish on the question, if an Avodah Zarah, a statue, so not just a statue that's there for decorative, but one that's actually used for worship, if it breaks on its own. We know if a goy breaks it, that's for sure it's bottle, and then therefore you're allowed to have hana from it. What if it broke by itself? So Rav Yechanan said it still remains. Also, Rish Lakish had argued that it's mutter. And we started going through the ins and outs of that. And one thing we mentioned is Rabbi Yochanan said the reason why it's also is because you have a Vadai that was worshipped at one point. You have a Sophic whether he was Mavapalit. So therefore, that's only a Sophic against a Vadai, and you can't do that. If you have a Vadai that's also, then a Sophic to make it Mutter can't override that.
And we said it's really not a Vadai against the Sophic.
So with Avodah Zarah, it is a Vadai against the Sophic. We tried to bring a proof against Rabbi Yochanan from the case of the Chover with his produce, where we said on the face of it, it's a Vadai that it was chayiv in Truma and Meiser. It's a Sophic whether he took Truma and Meiser from it before he dies, and yet we say we're allowed to eat it. So that contradicts Rav Yechanan. So we answered no. There it's either a Vadai versus a Vadai. It's a Vadai that was chayiv in Meiser, but versus that of the Vadai, the Chazaka, that he will have taken Truma and Meiser before he died. Or that it's a Sophic versus a Sophic, which is not necessarily his produce, even once Gemar Malacha has taken place, not necessarily was it done in such a way that it will be chayiv in Truma and Meiser. It could have been brought into the house before the Gemar Malacha was finished.
But in our case,
that's the point. So we still haven't disproved Rabbi Yechanan's point that a Sophic of Heter can't override a Vadai of Iser. And again, what Tosfos had pointed out yesterday, even if it's a very likely Sophic like this, Rish Lakish had pointed out once a statue breaks, it's very common that the goy will give up on the statue, but nevertheless, the Sophic is still a Sophic. Okay. So now another one. You're telling me, Rav Yechanan, that a Sophic cannot override a Vadai and make something mutter? Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example where it does. Mahatan, you're Omer Rav Yehuda. It happened with the Shivcha Knanis, of a Mesik in Rimon. Rimon is the name of a city, or the name of an area, whatever. It's in Eretz Yisrael, yeah. Rashi explains that Mesik means Gavra Alma, means a powerful person who makes it hard for other people. Like he forces them to give him things or whatever. Mesik, Meloshin, Mosa or Mosa, physically or based on his power or whatever it is. The point is that the point is that he makes life hard for people around him. So in that case, Mesik is a coercer. Yeah, the type of person who coerces other people to do things for him. Now he was a Yid. His Shivcha Knanis is the Shivcha. Hello, his shifcha is the shifcha knanis of a Jew. Tosfos mentions another girsa that's not meisik, but rather moisik, a person whose job is to harvest olives, is to harvest and press olives. Why that's negea, we'll talk about in a couple of lines, why it's negea, whether he's a meisik, a person who lords it over other people, or just an olive presser. Anyway. This person, she threw a stillborn child into a pit. So the child had been born. Now she threw it into a pit. But some of them, of course, learned that it was her own, that it was her own baby. She herself had miscarried, and now she threw it into a pit. Some of them, of course, want to say maybe it was her mistress's baby. Anyway,
was it a boy or a girl?
That's what we have to figure out. Uvah koyin v'hasis. So a koyin came and looked down into the pit. Leida in Zachar in the Keva to figure out if it is a boy or is it a girl, because that'll be Negea, how long the mother is going to be Tomei after the birth, a week or 2 weeks, as it says in the Torah. Now, what is this? So the question is, though, do you have a problem of Tumah V'Tara? Because if the Nafel is there at the bottom of the pit, he's going to become Tomei from overshadowing it. So the case came to the Chachamim. Do we say that he's Tomei or not? V'tiharuhu, and the Chachamim said the Kohen is Tar. That's the question. And they declared him Tar, because in that pit you have a Chulda and a Bardless. A Chulda is a weasel, a Bardless is various possibilities. It could be a panther, it can be a hyena, it can be in some places actually translated as something like a skunk, whatever it is. The point is, Mitzurian Shum, they're very commonly there, and therefore very likely they dragged away the body into their hole, which is at the bottom of the pit over there. So therefore the body wasn't necessarily there when the Kohen looked in. Now, what is this Kohen doing looking in the first place? Rashi over here says that he was a Chacham Moraira, that he was a Talmud Chacham who wanted to be able to pass in the Halacha. What is it? Is she Tomei for 7 days or 14? Is it she have Yemei Tahara for 33 or 66 days? On the other hand, Tosfos over here and Rashi himself and a few other places says that no, he was a Kohen Shoter, because what's he doing? Trying to be taking a chance on being Tomei Lames. He didn't know necessarily whether the holder or Baudelus dragged away the body.
But not even that. He wanted to find the body.
Right. Well, the point is, he was a Kohen Shoter because he should have realized he can't be Metamei. He can't be Metamei himself.
He wanted to, but he could not.
That's the point. That's the point. So Rashi says he was a Chacham. Tosfos says he was a Rashi himself in some other places says he was a Shoter. The Avoda actually points out on this that maybe that now it becomes relevant to know whether it's a guy, a mastic, the kind of guy who harasses other people and forces them to do what he wants, or was, like Rashi says, or was he a mastic, a person who harvests olives? If he was a mastic, then fine. The Kohen may have been forced into it. In that case, you can say he was a chacham. Fine, it's also, but he had no choice because the guy's pressuring him into it. As opposed to, if the guy is a mastic, if he's just an olive grower, then why is the Kohen doing this? It must be that he was a shaita. Anyway, the point is, now, what do we have in this case? On the face of it, it's a definite thing that the shivcha threw the nafel into the pit. This, whether the holder or the bowdless dragged the body away, is only a suffix. And yet we're saying that the suffix overrides the vade, and we don't make the kohen tummy. So why not? If according to Rabbi Yochanan, that shouldn't work. If we have a vade of truma, and we have a suffix whether the truma is there or not, then yeah. Tosfos, by the way, gets a little bit into the discussion over here.
Chacham said he was tar.
That's the question one. Tosfos points out the reason why the Kohen had to figure this out is because even though she's a Shivcha Knanis, if it was in fact her baby, even if we learn that it was her baby, she still has the same dinim of Tumah V'Tahara as a regular Jewish woman. She would still be Tomei for that. Tosfos learns based on a Gemara and Shabbos because the same thing as the concept of Bris Mila applies to a Shivcha and her baby. The same thing. This concept of Tumah V'Leiva. Come on. A fly is not Metame.
Fly is not
Metame. No, it's not one Shemayna Shrusted. Come on, let's keep on track. Okay, listen. The point is, Tosfos says, so again, if we learn that it was the Shivcha's baby, then he has to know if the Shivcha herself was Tomei Leida for 7 or 14 days. According to the Rishonim, who learned that it was her mistress's, that it was the Mastic's wife's baby, well, then we need to know whether the Mastic's wife is Tomei or Tara. Anyway, the point is, Tosfos also gets into the discussion.
What do we say? That's the
question. It's a Vada against the Suffolk. And now Tosfos points out, by the way, don't we usually have the rule, if it's a Suffolk Tumah and Rishos HaRabim, you're Tara. If it's a Suffolk Tumah and Rishos HaYachid, you're Tomei. So never mind the whole question of Vaday versus Suffolk. Let's figure it out if it was Rishos HaYachid or Rishos HaRabim.
Right.
So Tosfos says there's two possibilities. It could have been, we could say that the Bor was Rishos HaRabim, but the case would be where the Bor is narrow enough that when the Kohen is looking in, his head covers the entire surface of the Bor. And therefore, that can't be considered a Suffolk Tumah Rishos HaRabim. Or you could say that the pit was a Rishos HaYachid, but nevertheless you could say that there's enough of a Suffolk whether the holder or Baudelus dragged away the body, and therefore that there's not necessarily a Suffolk Tumah over there. Also, Tosfos points out might be the Bor itself is a Rishos HaYachid and the Kohen is a Rishos HaRabim. Whatever. So the whole thing of Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Hashanah Yachid doesn't necessarily factor into the question over here.
Make it a Noah, he had to cover the whole thing.
No. If he covered it, as long as he was overshadowing the body, then he would make the oil himself. But the point is, the first point was, if the hole is so small that he himself, looking over it, covers the entire thing, then it's not a Rosh Hashanah anymore. Anyway, that's a side thing. The point is, we have a vadai that there was tumah there on the face of it. We have a suffix whether the tumah was dragged away before the kohen looked in, and yet we're saying he's tahor. How does that fit with what Rabbi Yochanan is saying? The answer is loy tema hitila nafel labur. Don't say that this shifcha definitely threw the nafel into the pit. Ela emi hitila kimin nafel labur. She threw something which we think might have been a nafel. So then we have a spek seka. Maybe it was a nafel, maybe not. It might have been, for example, Rashi says shvir mole ruach. It might have been an amniotic sac that develops early in the pregnancy that doesn't have an actual formed baby in it yet. Then there's no tumor in that yet.
When do you start having tumor?
Once the baby has reached, once the gestation, 40 days, I think it is, yeah. But before that, it's considered ruach, or it's considered mayim, or whatever.
40 days is Gemara.
From conception. So over here, it might have been, so number one, we're not even sure it was a nafel. And number two, there's also the question whether the holder or Baudelus dragged it away before the Kohen got there. That's already a spek
veka. This is the second spek veka
Okay, so the question is,
the baby was dead.
Obviously was dead, right.
No. Yeah. What? Right.
Yeah.
So when she was pregnant, the baby died.
Either that, or either that, or she miscarried, and it was born dead. Yeah, whatever. Doesn't really matter. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, the Braita says that the Kohen looked in to see if it was a boy or a girl. If it's a suffix, whether it was even a baby or not, whether it's something that's even considered a baby in halacha, then you should be talking about that. The answer is Hakakama. Yes, that's what the Braita means. It means Leida im ruach hipila im nefel hitila. First of all, we have to figure out whether what she threw in there was ruach, was something that just counts as wind, as air, in other words, something insubstantial, that's not mitame, or whether it was an actual baby. And then further, the Kohen was looking in to figure out if it is a baby, to know whether it's a boy or a girl. So therefore, it's a speck speka, and Rav Yochanan has no problem if it's not a vaday in the first place, if it's a suffix, whether there was tumah there, whether there was even tumah there in the first place.
So that's
why, because the suffix against the suffix. It's a suffix whether there was a napal there in the first place. And then there's a suffix. What if there was a napal, was it dragged away by the holder or bowerless before the Kohen came? So what suffix versus a suffix? Fine, Rav Yochanan has no problem with that.
And the Rish Lakish already is.
Rish Lakish doesn't deal with that anyway. Rish Lakish wasn't even addressing the issue of Bade versus Suffolk. Or another way you can answer, given to holder or bardless, since a holder and a bardless, since these weasels or whatever these little creatures are, very commonly live at the bottom of a burr, and in this case, apparently they knew as a general thing that they have a nest at the bottom of this burr. It's not even a suffix whether they dragged it away. For sure, as soon as it landed there, they dragged it away. Therefore, you can't say it's a vaday that was tumma there versus a suffix rather against the suffix. Just the opposite. Just the opposite. It's a vaday versus fine. You could argue it's a vaday that there was a baby, but there's also a vaday that they took it away immediately, and therefore, by the time the Kohen looks, it's already gone.
It doesn't.
So therefore, that's the point. It's not a vaday versus a suffix. Right. Okay. So again, no contradiction against Rabbi Yochanan from that. Yeah. One more detail, Tosis points out, in order for us to say that the Kohen is Tahar, we would also have to say, the fact is, if we're saying that usually people would throw their Nephilim into this pit, shouldn't he be conceivably Tomei from previous Nephilim? The answer is, obviously, it must be before she threw it in, we knew for a fact there was no Nephil previously at the bottom of it. It had already been checked and found that there was none. So now we only have a question about this one. So therefore, again, according to the first Svara of the Gemara, it doesn't matter. Previous Nephilim would have long since been gone. The question is about this one. And according to the first answer of the Gemara, we're not even sure whether there was a Nephil there in the first place. Therefore, we have no reason to be Matamah.
When a body decomposes, how long does the tumor stay?
Until, I'm not sure at what point.
We did that whole thing. Let's have complete.
No. Well, okay. Yeah, Rokov. Rokov is a special case. But in the ordinary case, where there's no Rokov, is a very rare thing. Only when the body is buried in inside a marble or whatever, coffin or something like that doesn't decompose along with the body and without clothes and whatever. We're not talking about that. But when it decomposes, okay. I don't know at what point exactly. It's not Makabel Torah anymore. But
well,
here,
it doesn't have any flesh.
No. Because bones can be metamorphosed.
No, the complete skeleton will be metamorphosed.
Yes, that's true. But eventually, especially with a navel, the skeleton eventually decays also. It's false bones. It's mostly cartilage. Fine, but that's not the point. We're not even talking about how long it takes to decompose. We're talking about the holder or barbless take it away. Yeah.
Right.
It was a hole in the ground. The pastures during the winter season, they would use it. During the rainy season, they would use it to store water. And during the summertime, which is, I guess, when the story happened, it would be dry. In this case, it's not the Hoshen Bach crowd. Yeah,
from knowing that they were babies.
Previously, they were gone already. By the time they weren't so picky, first of all. By the time it comes the rainy season, months after this, any remains will be long gone. They'll be
Perrier, Avion,
so there's nothing.
All right. Okay, onward. Fine. Now we're going to get back to the main machlokas.
It wasn't for it.
Okay. Now we're getting back to the main topic, which is the machlokas of Rav Yochanan and Rish Lakish. We digressed to ask about Rav Yochanan, how is he saying Ein Sof Mosim Midei Vaday, and we said neither of the cases, the case of the Chover with the Truma and Meister, or the case of this Nephil, neither one contradicts Rav Yochanan's premise that Ein Sof Mosim Midei Vaday. So now we're going to get back to Rav Yochanan and Rish Lakish.
We're going back because
Rav Yochanan is going to ask questions on Rish Lakish to try and contradict him, and Rish Lakish is later on going to ask questions about Rav Yochanan to do the same thing. We have to figure it out. That's the derech of the Gemara. Is that we have to? Yeah. So So Rav Yochanan asks on Rish Lakish as follows. We learned in our Mishnah, Mutta Tavnis Yad Tavnis Regal. We said in our Mishnah that if you find that even though broken pieces of a statue, we said are Mutta, but if you find an image of a hand or a foot, then we said they're also banam, because that type of thing, an individual hand or an individual foot, is sometimes worshipped by itself. The question is, amai hoshvarim ninu? Why should it be osur? The fact is, it's broken pieces. According to me, that I'm saying that even if it that if it broke by itself, that's not enough to be master at fine. Then I can say not only a hand or a foot, but any broken piece. If we know that the statue was worshipped, is going to be awesome. But you, the Shlokish, are saying even a statue that was worshipped and it broke by itself and all the pieces are now mutabah na'ah because we assume the goyim were mevatalit, so why should an individual hand or foot be any different? The answer is HaTogim HaShmuel, Boim the Novus Sitzan, because after all we know from the previous part of the Gemara, Shmuel already explained, we're not just talking about Stam, a loose hand or foot, we're talking about that you find it on a basis, according to Rashi, that you find it, that the Goyim placed it on a pedestal, and therefore obviously they're worshipping it, or according to Tosfos, that to begin with it was made with a built-in base, so therefore it shows that it was obviously made specifically for that, the hand or the foot is made on a base. So therefore, it's not just a piece that broke off a statue. It's a piece that was cast or carved or what have you in that way originally. So that's different. Obviously, Rish Lakish is not going to hold that such a thing as mutter. Okay. Well, that's the point that we were saying before. That's the point when at the beginning of the sugya, right after the Mishnah, when we mentioned Shmuel's point, we had Shmuel's point that if you find broken pieces of Avodah Zarah, then it's mutter. One way of looking at it, so we had two ways of looking at what Shmuel was saying. Is he saying that even if it breaks by itself, it's mutter, which would be like Rish Lakish is saying, or is he saying, like Rabbi Yochanan, that no, if it breaks by itself, it would be osur. However, if we find it and we don't know whether it broke by itself or whether the goy broke it, we should logically assume the goy usually protect their statues. They're not likely to just break randomly. More likely, if it's broken, it means the goy was angry at it and broke it. In that case, then that's valid.
We
will
have to say that
Reish
Lakish held that since it broke by itself, the goy would assume that it
would assume if it can't protect itself, it can't protect me either. Right. Yeah. Okay. The Gemara said that. Yeah, we learned that in the
Mishnah.
That was Rish Lakish's point.
And Rabbi Yochanan disagreed with it. He said that he would have.
Not if he goy would say that.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because we said before about Dogoyim. We said yesterday about Dogoyim that the according to Rabbi Yochanan, the goyim still continued worshipping Dogoyim. They just also started honoring the threshold also where they found the pieces of Dogoyim. And according to Rish Lakish, they changed their allegiance from now on. They didn't worship this particular idol of Dogoyim anymore. They started worshipping the threshold.
Then the threshold fell, and then they decided that
that's
whoever knocked him down is more powerful, and then they started worshiping him.
Yeah, come on.
Then they
started
to worship
By the way, I mean, and not to get too far off topic, but by the way, as far as this business where it says that the priest of Dagon from then on wouldn't step over the threshold, you find a pasuk in Tanya hundreds of years later. Tanya was towards the end of the first Beit Mikdash. He says that there's going to come a point when Hashem is going to punish, among others, anybody who jumps over the threshold. One meaning of it, some of them are Farshim on the pasuk say, refers back to this. In other words, these people, Jews or Goyim for that matter, who respect and worship Dagon to the extent that they follow this ritual of not stepping over the threshold, and eventually Hashem is going to deal with that, and therefore they jump over it, and therefore eventually Hashem is going to deal with that. The threshold is where the door, the place
right.
where the door that you step on when you normally step on it when you're going in and out of the door. Okay, fine. Back to the Gemara.
Eisvei.
So Rav Yochanan asked on Rish Lakish. Here's another contradiction. We learn later on in our parak, a goy can be mevatel an avodah zarah of his own or an avodah zarah of somebody else's, which means somebody else's doesn't even mean it belongs to somebody else. It can even mean if it's not even the particular deity that he worships. So Rashi, because that's as long as he's an Ovid Avodah Zarah. We'll see on Amad Beis.
That's
be
a really interesting
but in other words, yeah. So therefore, so Rashi says, for example, so you have this guy worships Per, that guy worships Merkulis. You find a statue of Per which you want to be Mevatel. The guy who worships Merkulis, even though as far as he's concerned, Per is nothing, he can still be Mevatel to Per, right? And it is a valid bit.
Antibacterial, so.
No, it's not
his. Yeah.
That's what we're saying. Shalom v'shalchaveh. We'll learn more details about this on
the
day.
And if the other one comes back and he
too late. It's already in the Sabbath.
But a Goy is going to serve a Yid's or whatever, making sort of one's own, he has no power over that.
But that's something else, right? If we'll learn later on in the parak, indeed, if a person were to worship something that belongs to somebody else, Einonim Osa Dava Shein Shaloi. Fine, but here we're talking about you found the idol, a Jew found the idol, for example, a tesker. He wants to be able to have Hanah from it, so he gets a Goy to be Mavapolis for him. We'll see on Amad Bey's an example where one of
the
Amadoyim did
that. Why did Aram have to break all the idols? Why you just muddle them?
If he found an Ovidavid Azorah who was willing to be Mavapol, then fine. But also, he wanted to make a point, right? So at a time like that, when everybody's worshipping Avodah Zarah, you want to demonstrate that it's worth it.
He just meant to make a point.
Yeah. But to
destroy them, once they were destroyed, they wouldn't worship them anyway, even if they were Mavapol or not, whether he was the din of a Jew or not.
But he didn't have to, that's the question.
If he found somebody who was willing to be Mavapol, that's fine, but he wasn't going to go looking around for that. His point was to demonstrate that they're worth it. Okay, onward.
He was a Yid.
At this point, it's still Ben Noach, I don't know. Actually, you make a very good point, because when we're going to talk on Amud Beis, that in order for a Goy to be Mavatal of a Dezara, it has to be what's called Yodea Betiv of a Dezara. He has to, even if he doesn't worship this particular Geshke, he has to at least know what Avodah Zarah is all about, like believe in some sort of Avodah Zarah.
Okay.
As opposed to, for example, a Muslim would not be able to be Mavatal of a Dezara.
So how could he?
That's the point, though. He's not being Mavatal, he's breaking them. He's breaking them. Pieces maybe are still also Bahana. No, we're not getting into that. So we're talking about to be Mavatal, but in a way that the pieces should be Moser Bahana.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, so we learn later in the parak again that a Goy can be Mavatal and have a desire of his own or somebody else's. The Yisrael ain't a Mavatal of Eretz Kechavim, Shalev Kechavim. But a Yisrael, a Jew, is not able to be Mavatal. Not being able to be Mavatal, in other words, in the sense that it should become Mutar Bahana. A Jew cannot do anything to a Goy's Getchke that will make it Mutar Bahana. So the question is, why not? Amai, according to Rish Lakish, why not? Let's say the Yid breaks the statue. According to Rabbi Yochanan, fine. Unless a Goy breaks it with intention to mivatal it, then it's not a valid bittul. But according to Rish Lakish, if even a statue breaks by itself, and already it's Mutar Bahana, even though it was worshipped before that, why should a Yid breaking it be any worse than it breaking by itself? Once a Goy sees that it's broken, he'll say it's worthless. Obviously, it couldn't protect itself from the Yid. It can't protect me either.
According to
Rish Lakish, that's the question. Why is Rish Lakish can't argue with that Mishnah later on. So what did he do with it? The answer is, Omar Abaye Shapachsa. So Abaye answers the case that we're talking about over there is not where a Yid broke it into pieces. We're talking about where a Yid dented it, made it, flattened it out. He took a hammer, for example, and started banging on it until he flattened out the features.
What's
of it.
The difference
is that breaking it means now there's something missing from it. There's substance missing from
flattening
it.
Flattening also.
No, flattening, there's nothing, there's no substance.
Flattening the nose.
There's no substance missing from it. Before it contained a pound of metal, now it still contains a pound of metal, it's just in a different shape.
It's a pounded pound.
Okay, good. Okay, so then you could argue Rish Lakish. So Rish Lakish can argue, therefore, that what does that Mishnah mean? That a Yisrael cannot be Mavatal and Avodah Zarah of a Goy only if he flattened it. But if he broke it, Rish Lakish might say that's not what the Mishnah means. Then maybe a Yid could be Mavatal because it's no different than it breaking by itself. So the question is, why should it be any different if he only flattened it, if he dented it? We learn later on in our parak, one way in which a Goy can be mevatel of a dezara is if he dents it, if he flattens out its features, even if it's not missing anything of its substance. Again, it still weighs the same as it did before. And that's a valid bittul. Why should we argue that if a Yid does it, it's not a valid bittul, but if a Goy does, then it is. What's the difference? The answer is Hanimila Depachta Ovid Kechavim. That's just it. If a Goy does that, then it shows that he's Mavazit, that he's Mavatalit. Abel Pachta Yisrael Lebatla. But Rish Lakish can argue if a Yid does that, that's not the same thing as it breaking. When it breaks, then the Goy will say, okay, it couldn't save itself, whatever. Here, if it gets dented, if it gets flattened out, the Goy can rationalize to himself, okay, so this Avodah Zarah is more willing to tolerate that kind of thing. You know, it doesn't, somebody can go at it with a hammer and it's still not an answer, but it still has power. That doesn't mean that it was powerless. The point is, as opposed to if it breaks, where now it doesn't exist in its original form anymore, then it might be considered lawful. The Rava Amar, Rava says, let me give you a different answer. La'olam kipach se Yisrael nami bafla. No, you could argue that there's no difference between a yid or a goy flattening it out. Whether a yid or a goy hammers on it, flattens it out, either way it should by rights be bafla. So why is there a difference? Why is the Mishnah saying that if a yid does it, it's not bafla, and if a goy does it, it's not? Elegzera, it's rather a segzera, dilma magvala. What happens? The Yisrael might first be zoicha in this statue. He might pick it up. So he found a hefker idol, for example, and he picks it up, which at that point he's accomplished a kinyan on it. But hoder mevatalah, and then he's going to be mevatalit. And the problem is that for sure wouldn't work. Behave avodas kechavim biyad Yisrael, because then we have to apply the rule, which is when you have an avodah zarah in the hands of a Jew, once a Jew owns a statue which is used for worship. And b'chol avodas kechavim biyad Yisrael ain't a b'teila loyim. Such a statue can never be bottled. This that we're
whatever
saying.
Whatever you do to it.
What do you mean, what do you do to it?
You smash it.
That's it.
Break
you have to just destroy it completely. We're going to learn later on what exactly you have, what exactly you need to do to destroy it in
so
such a way that.
Zero, basically.
Okay, so right. So now Rashi learns over here that what it is the fundamental concept that Avodah Zarah in the hands of a Jew can never be bottled. Rashi learns is Daraisa. So the Chachamim therefore made a Gzera, given that if the Yid were to first pick it up and then try to be Mavasal, it wouldn't work. Therefore, the Chachamim made a Gzera and said that, therefore, even if the Yid does not first pick it up or is not cloning it in any way, but he starts by denting it, he starts by smashing its face flat, nevertheless, we're going to say it still doesn't work.
Why did
it make? Because it's a Gzera in order to safeguard the case, because otherwise, if you allow it, if you say that he smashes it first and then picks it up with Mutter, he might do it the other way around. Pick it up first, be Zoycha in it, then smash it, and that wouldn't work. Some Rishonim learned that actually the whole concept, this that we're saying, that a Yid Zavad Azara can never be bottled, that itself is only Zerabama. So in that case, wouldn't it be a Gzera for a Gzera? So one answer is, as we often say, that the two Gzeras are interdependent. You can't have one without the other. Therefore, they had to make both of them. And another answer that some of the Mephoshim give is when it comes to Avodah Zarah, we don't mind having a Gzera or Gzera. Avodah Zarah, we have to stay away, so far away from that the Chachamim don't mind making a Gzera on top of a Gzera. Yeah. No, it's because he's not necessarily rejecting Avodah Kochavim as a whole. He's rejecting this particular statue. This particular statue, I don't believe that the spirit, the Ruchni spirit, the star or whatever that rested on it, rests on it anymore. But in general, he believes.
Now, let's go back to the question that we raised. How is it that non-Jew is able to be mevatel a chepet that is not his? And that is a deity that he never believed in the first place.
Because the fact is he believes in some kind of Avodah Zarah, and therefore for that purpose we don't care whether he believes in this particular one or not. And as far as that it's not his, so what we're talking about over here, we're talking about where it's in nobody's possession right now. We're going to learn on Amud Beis, an example where a Yid finds it as Hefker. He finds it on the streets, for example.
Hefker, cannot belong.
If it belongs to another guy, I don't know if it works for him to be Mavasalit, but once it's not. Maybe not, practically speaking. Otherwise you could have a goy be mevatel some other goy's of a desara and then go start taking it. Something I don't know if that works. But anyway, we're talking about over here where you, a yid, want to be able to have hana from the stuff of a desara, for example, to melt it down for scrap metal or whatever it is. And therefore you need a goy to be mevatel.
The trick is that, and is this still the case, if you find it, pick it up, then give it to a non-Jew. Then
we just said, once you pick it up, you're claiming it. Too late.
You're in trouble.
Too late, yeah.
So what happened in the case you buy antiques statues that actually have been of Avodah Zarah?
So then you have a real problem. That you have to ask the question whether there was a proper bissel done to them. If there was a proper bissel done to them, then you're good. But if not, then okay, so we're going to talk later on. We're going to deal later on. We'll have in a few blocks. We'll have the case, for example, if a guy sells a statue to a Jew to a Jewish smith, where he figures the Jew is probably going to melt it down for metal, then we can say that's considered a bissel. But if he sells it to a Yid who's not a smith, not necessarily, because who says the Yid is going to melt it down? As far as the goy is concerned, the Yid may actually worship it, chas v'shalom, or even if not, he may keep it intact, and therefore he's not necessarily mevatel. So yes, it might be an actual problem.
So
again, if you're not sure whether it was worshipped or not, then you can argue. Then you have a spec face over there. That's different. But if you know for a fact, if you have some way of knowing for a fact that it was worshipped, you could be a real problem.
If you look,
what would you have to do in that case? You would have to destroy it.
you see there's a little chip on each one of them.
I know, those are where they have crosses under the windows. I know, because it used to be a monastery, right.
So probably, before they signed the document, they probably had a non-Jew.
Maybe not, because we talked yesterday briefly about the question, what kinds of crosses are off the Bahana and what are not? The kind that they worship versus the kind that are decorative. They don't worship the ones that are outside the building, under the windows or above the windows or whatever. Those are the pashtas, just part of the decoration.
Can you light candles, either Shabbos candles or Hanukkah candles or whatever type of Jewish candles when there's a tzelem in the room?
Whoa.
Does it make a difference?
I have no idea.
That's a good question.
I have no idea.
That happens in hospitals.
It happens in hospitals. Okay. I don't think it's very common for them to have crosses hanging in the natural.
I've been in Europe. No, it's not. They have a prayer.
Oh, like they have a prayer room or whatever.
They have a prayer room. And what they do is they have a...
It's a good question. I don't know.
In all the rooms
they have.
It's a very good question. I don't know.
Yeah, the Rav says something about that. There's a definite yes, no, or maybe.
Okay.
I forgot.
There was when I was a resident, there was a tellin.
Yeah.
It was Hanukkah time.
Oh.
So I took it out, put it outside, and I did the Hanukkah.
Right. Meanwhile, they got a picture of you in the front page of the newspaper. You trying to convert.
Okay, new, come on. It is Purim, but we're still also learning Torah. So let's get back to business.
Yeah.
Okay. Fine.
Story.
Okay, so the bottom line is, therefore, there's no contradiction from that Mishnah to the Shlokish, because either we can use a Abaye's answer that there's a difference between whether the Yid or the Goy flattened it, or we can say that according to Rava, there's no difference between a Yid or a Goy flattening it in principle, but it's a Gzeira, and therefore we don't allow it if a Yid does. But it's still different, still doesn't prove anything. What we'd say, if it broke on its own, where a Shlokish is arguing with Mutter, maybe it could be. The Mishnah doesn't contradict it. So Rav Yochanan tries another contradiction against Rish Lakish. We learn in a Braisa, Akum Shehevi Avonim Min HaMerkulis, if a goy takes stones from Merkulis, so Merkulis we're going to talk more about in the next parak, but it's that famous type of Avodah Zarah, which is made of a pile of stones, and the way of worshipping it is by throwing stones at it and making the pile bigger and bigger. So now, if a goy takes stones from a Merkulis, the chipa behem drachen v'tautiyos, and he uses them to pave roads or tautiyos. Tautiyos on the face of it means theaters, but in Tisriyad, the Jewish is stratios, which means highways. Anyway, the point is, it doesn't really matter as far as halacha. The point is, the Rashi learns that just him taking away the stones themselves is already considered bissel of them. The Rambam learns that it's not the taking them away that's been vassal them, but the fact that he's using them for paving. That already makes them bissel. Anyway, mutaris, then they're mutar b'hana, and you're allowed to walk on those roads, and you'd be allowed to reuse those paving stones for something else later. On the other hand, but if a Jew did the same thing, he took stones from a Merkulis and used them to pave roads or highways, absurdis, then they would be also b'hana. Again, you have to ask, Amai, why should they be also b'hana if a Jew did it? Shouldn't it be the equivalent of an Avodah Zarah that broke spontaneously? Why is a Jew breaking it any worse than it breaking spontaneously? And again, the answer is Hachanami Kedirava. Here also we can answer, like Rava said, that in principle it should be Mutter, but the Chachamim made a Gzeira to make it also, because what if he does it the other way around? What if he first picks it up and then breaks it?
So it's a
Siyag of Torah. It's a Siyag of Chachamim. Rashi uses the expression over here, by the way, that he may pick up the entire Merkulis. So the Rid asks on that, the Tosfos Rid asks on that, a Merkulis is a pile of stones. How are you physically able to pick up the whole thing at once? So therefore he says two answers. First of all, we don't necessarily mean picking it up. There are other ways of being koina things also. We know you can be koina things by chalifin, and you can be koina them by agav kalka, and you have various other ways that a person conceivably could be koina it. Second of all, he says, maybe what we mean is, once the Chachamim made this Gzera, when we're talking about statues and idols and whatnot that can actually be picked up, like our previous case, then the Chachamim extended it even to ones that can't physically be picked up, like a Merkulis. They still extended the same Gzera to them that we don't want, that nobody should be confused. Exactly. One other thing, by the way, I forgot to mention before, when we were talking about a Yid picking it up and being Zoicha in it, the Ritva points out, on the face of it, if it's also b'ana, how are you being koined anyway by picking it up or anything? And the answer is
cannot koined something that's also b'ana.
If it's also b'ana, it means you're not allowed to have b'ana. It means how are you being koined? And he answers,
but that's a question.
How can we kind of something that's also banah? The answer he gives is basically similar to the way we say chometz on Pesach doesn't belong to you, but the Torah treats it as if it does belong to you, in the sense that you're on Ba'yiro or Ba'yimasa. Burba Shasram is another example, right? So this would be another example. Even though you're not allowed to own it, nevertheless, you have the ability to be koine it to the extent that now you become liable for the issur of owning it. And that the fact that it can't be bottle anymore will now kick in.
Seems to be evident that you could still koine something that you're not allowed to have an offering.
Are you able to be koine chametz during Pesach? So the answer is, in a way, not. In a way, yes. On the one hand, it's not. In a way, not. For example, you want to be in a kaddish, a woman with it, it wouldn't work because it doesn't have because it doesn't have any marker. But it's in your reshus, in the sense that you're over on Baal Yerah, Baal Yerah.
Right.
This is a similar thing. Yeah.
You cannot do a mitzvah with it, but it's still in your reshus.
Right. Exactly. So that's the point that Richard makes. All right. Anyway. So we answered that, like Rava, that technically, yes, the stones from Merkulis, if a Yid took them, should be Musa Bahana, but it's a Xerah, and therefore not. Okay, Eitzvi, he asked another one on him. Again, we learn later on in our parak, if a Goy stands down an Avodah Zarah for its needs, so in other words, Tzorkoi rather means for his needs. So, for example, you have a wooden Avodah Zarah. The guy takes some sandpaper, and he wants some wood. He takes a chisel or whatever. He wants some wood from it to use for his purposes, right? And the din is both the statue and the pieces are now mutar b'hana, because by doing that, obviously, he shows that he's mevatel, that he's not using. If a guy does it, right. Litzarka, on the other hand, if he did the standing for its needs, he wanted to make the statue more beautiful.
Right.
Then the din is hiyasur of a shipuya mutarin. The idol itself still stays mutar, but the sawdust now becomes mutar because the sawdust just gets thrown away. It's not something you would worship anymore.
Right.
But the yisrael sheshipa avodas kechavim. But if a Jew stands down with avodas zarah, bein l'tzorka, bein l'tzorka, he v'shipuya asur. And whether he's doing it because he himself wants the chips or whether he's doing it to beautify the statue, either way, the pieces are awesome. So again, the question is, why would it be any worse than the case of a statue that broke on its own? Why the fact that a yid is involved make it worse, according to the Shulchan?
Now, let me ask you one thing.
Yeah.
Avodah Zarah, the bittul process of Avodah Zarah, is this a din deraisa?
No, it's definitely deraisa. If it was derabanan, if the Torah says an Avodah Zarah, it's also not. No. This concept that a goy can be mevatel of a dezara, it has to be deraisa. If it was derabanan, then abanan have no ability to create something.
So shouldn't there be a pasuk that
we'll deal with it later on in the perek when we get mainly more into the din of a bittul? We'll deal with where we get this concept from.
Well, okay, so we have it.
Yeah,
because it's just so puzzling. I was always bothered by that question that you asked. How can a non-Jew that doesn't believe in this Avodah Zarah be mevatel something that someone else's?
Okay.
It's not even his, and it's a different, you know.
So we'll deal with it later on. We have a limit for it. Anyway, so the answer is Hachanami Kedirava. Here also we can answer like Rava, that in principle if a Yid sanded it down, the pieces should be mutter, but again we make the same data as before. Tosfos asks the question, by the way, why is Rabbi Yochanan asking on the Shlokish all these questions when the answer comes out, if for each one the answer is we're going to answer it like Rava? Why bother asking each question if we can always deflect them by saying that by saying? So a couple different mafarshim talk about different possibilities. First of all, it might not be that Rabbi Yochanan asked all of these to Rish Lakish, and then each one he answered with Rava's answer, and then he asked him the next one. He might have just piled on him all the questions one after the other, and Rish Lakish answers by all of them by saying we can appeal to what Rava is saying. Or it could be Rabbi Yaakov Emden learns that maybe these are not questions of Yochanan after Rish Lakish. Maybe these are the Bnei HaYeshiva. In different yeshivas, they brought up these seeming contradictions to Rish Lakish, and in each yeshiva, independently, they hit on the answer that we can explain it like Rava. I think Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, we can also say it's Lahagdil Torah or Lahadira. In a sense, when we bring in these different things, we can see how each one of them is relevant. Each one of them is relevant, even though it may not seem to be relevant at the time. But we find it relevant someplace else when we learn Torah, and that's Lahagdil Torah or Lahadira, to make the Torah greater, to show the depth of the Torah. One other answer Tosfos mentions elsewhere is that he may have been asking him one after the other, and each time the Shlokish answer is like Rava, but still the point is that Rav Yochanan wanted to see each time, do you have some better answer, or do you each time have to appeal to Rava? So far, except for the first one. The first one we had Shmuel's thing, but Imdin obviously done. That's talking about the handle right. First had a base of its own. And the second one we had Abaya's or Rava's answer. But yeah, so far the next two, all we have is Rava's answer. Actually, I mean, the Binyan Shloimeh has a long discussion about this. He says there are maybe ways in which we could be doichet to answer each one of them without having to appeal to Rava, but to appeal to Rava and Zera is a more straightforward way. Eighthly, so Rav Yochanan asked another question on Mishlokish. We learn later on in our parak, it's the next Mishnah, Rav Yosiyah Mishoichet V'zorah L'ruach HaMata L'yam, what do you do with a statue that is also B'hanah, and it's made out of metal? So we have a machlokas there in the Mishnah. Rav Yosi says what you do is you grind it up into powder, v'zorah L'ruach, and you throw the powder into the wind, HaMata L'yam, or you throw it into the sea. Amrulai. Now the Chachamim answered.
I'm coming. I'm in the chair.
The Chachamim answered. That's what Rav Yosi says. That's the proper way to destroy a metal of a desire. Grind it up and throw the dust of it away, or throw it into the sea. Some of the Mefarshim say it means that you throw the statue as a whole into the Yamamelach, into the Dead Sea, and that way nobody's ever going to find it. All the Mephoshim say, what it means is first you grind it up and then you throw the powder into any sea. Then in that case, you could throw it even into the Mediterranean or something. Anyway, the point is that Amrullah, the Chachamim said to him, that's not going to work. Afi Nasa Zevel, if you do that, if you throw the dust of it into the wind, you're trying to make it that no Yid should have Hana from it. But eventually, a Yid is going to end up having Hana from it because Afi Nasa Zevel, it ends up becoming fertilizer because that metal dust ends up going and then floating around in the air and eventually comes down to earth and becomes part of the dirt. And therefore, somebody is going to grow vegetables or whatever on it. And the Pasuk says, none of the banned substance should be in your hand. So nothing at all. So you can't say that you grind it up and throw it to the wind. So again, the question is, why are the Chachamim having a problem with Rav Yosi? Amai, to heavy kavod as Chachamim, chenishtaba me'ala. Again, according to the Shlokish, why can't we say the same way as if an avodah zarah broke spontaneously, then it's bottle, the same way if it was ground up, then it should be considered that it's broken, and the goy is mevatelet. So why are we concerned about having hanah from it? And again, the answer is Chachanami to the Rava. We can answer again like Rava, that in principle that should work, but we have a zera that prevents it from working. So he asked him another one. Rav Yosi ben Yassi, you know.
That's a different rabbi.
Before was Rav Yosi the Tana. This is Rav Yosi ben Yassi, and could be a Tana, could be an Amora, I don't know, but it's a different, yeah, the regular Rav Yosi is Rav Yosi ben Chalasa. This is Rav Yosi ben Yassi, you know. Mota Tsuras Drakoin, if you find an image of a dragon, which we're going to learn on Omer Bey, the dragon is one of the types of images that the Goyim would regularly worship, that they would generally make it specifically for the purpose of worship.
Dragon?
I don't know, the Chinese, we'll see. We'll see later on, the Gemara will define what exactly it has to look like to be considered a dragon for this purpose in Halacha. But if you find such a thing, but the Rosh is chosuk, but the head is chopped off, you're not sure if a Goy cut off the head, which would be Bissel, or a Jew cut it off, which would not be Bissel. So we say mutter, then it's mutter, it's not also bahana.
Because we have a suffix.
Well, so one second. Here we have, Rashi says here we have a sex theta. This particular statue of a dragon may never have been worshipped in the first place. And even if it was, maybe the goy was, maybe it was a goy, and then he was an apostle. So the question is, but on the other hand, Vada Yisrael Chosfei, but if we know for sure that a Jew cut off the head, also. So again, the question is, am I to have a kavod of chomish in the shtabah me'elah? Again, you're back to the question that why should it be any worse than if it broke on its own, where then the goy is mevatelet. Where here we should assume, even if it was worshipped, that once the yid cut off its head, the goy gives up on it. And again, the answer is, hachanami to the rabba. Yet again, we will answer like rabba. That in principle that should work, but because of a gzera, we're not going to allow it. By the way, I mean here we're saying we have a sex faker. So Tosfos points out that when it comes as we discussed yesterday, when you find broken pieces of a statue and we're not sure if it was worshipped or not, yes, it could be that it was worshipped and that a Yid broke it, but we have against that is the fact that if a Yid broke it, he would have probably gotten rid of the pieces because that's what you're supposed to do with Avodah Zarah. But over here, we're talking about, you know that a Yid cut off the head, therefore you only have one possibility of Hetzer. The fact is, okay, you see the pieces weren't gotten rid of, but you know that a Yid did it, therefore it doesn't work. Rabbi Yochanan asked another one.
Can you ask a goy to mevatel it?
Yes, we're going to see soon. We're going to discuss soon.
A Jew can ask a goy, and then it works.
And then it works. We'll have an example on the days. We'll have another example a little later in the parakeet. Okay, so Rabbi Yochanan asked another contradiction on our shlokish.
Right.
We learn in a Mishnah later on in our parak. We're going through all the Mishnahs of the parak at this point. Rabbi Yochanan. So we have a machloikas over there. If you have an asherah tree, so an asherah tree can be the tree itself is actually worshipped, or it can be that there's an avodah zarah placed under it, whatever. We'll deal with those details later on in the parak. But the point is, if you have an asherah tree, which is otah b'hanah, are you allowed to plant vegetables in its shade? So now, like this, during the summer, definitely not, because then the shade is benefiting them, because they wilt if there's too much sunlight on them. Therefore, you're benefiting from the asher. No question, that's awesome. Are you allowed to plant vegetables under it in the winter time? So the Chachamim say yes, because then you don't have, you're not really getting, you don't want shade, adarav, you want sun. Therefore, the tree is harming them. It's not benefiting from them. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi, I'm asked why Yerokas be Moshe Gshomim. Rabbi Yossi says you can't plant vegetables there during the winter here. No, but they shine via and they share a salehen because the leaves that fall off the tree fall on them and fertilizes them. So therefore, you're still benefiting from an asherah. But we'll deal with later.
The leaves when they fall?
When the leaves fall, yeah, they become mulch. Yeah, they become mulch and they become fertilizer, yeah. Now, the Chachamim obviously know that also. We'll deal with later on in the parak why it is that they still say it's mutter, because Zeb is a goat, and we'll get into it. But the point is, for our purposes, again, you have to ask Amai, according to the Shlokish, what should be the problem? To have a kavod is a chavim shenishkaber meila. Again, isn't the leaves falling off the tree the equivalent of an avodah zarah breaking? And therefore, it should be mutter. So why are we saying that it remains mutter? No, the answer is, here's a different answer. Shiny Hossam, the Iker Avodah Kachalim Kayemet. It's different over there because the main piece of the Avodah Zarah is still intact. The tree itself is still intact. You just have individual leaves falling off it. The question then is, but what about, we have the previous case, we had a previous case where a goy versus a Jew, Shipuyan is when he sanded down a wooden statue.
Right.
And we said the sawdust, yeah. The Iker Avodah Kachavim Kayemet, there you also have the main Avodah Zarah is still intact. And the Chatoni, look, Sorkah, Yasdor, Rashid, Kujia, Mutarim. And we said that if the Goy did it for the benefit of the Avodah Zarah, to make it more beautiful, even then, the sawdust is mutter, only the Avodah Zarah itself is also. So why over here should we say that the leaves, according to the Yossi, are going to be also, they should be mutter once they fell off the tree? Tosfos points out, I mean, the Gemara could have obviously pointed out there's a big difference between leaves falling off a tree, which happened by themselves, versus standing in Avodah Zarah, where he does it himself.
The difference is one is just a natural process,
one is happening by itself, versus the other one, the goy is at. You could argue, if the goy is doing it, l'tzarka, then you could argue, okay, there's more of a reason to say that he doesn't want these to be a piece of the Avodah Zarah anymore. He wants them to be all.
Not if it's a natural thing.
Right. So, okay, but nevertheless, Tosfos says, still, the question still is that we said before that nevertheless, even if Yisrael did it in principle, it would have been mutter if it hadn't been for Rava's Gzera. So therefore, the question is, then why should it be any different? Why is Rabbi Yossi saying that with the leaves falling off the tree, they're completely off the according to Rabbi Yossi? The answer is, Ravuna Brezir of Yeshua Omar. So the answer is, Ravuna Brezir of Yeshua answers, L'fisha ein avodas kovim b'teila derech b'dilosa. Because an avodah zarah cannot become bottle when what happens to it is part of the normal process of its growing. Yeah, a normal thing is a tree has leaves and eventually it sheds them and then grows new ones. So you can't say that there's any bittul involved at all. You can't say
the leaf falls.
But it's a natural part of the growth cycle. Leaves grow, they mature, eventually they get old and they fall off, and new leaves grow instead. You can't say that there's any kind of bittul involved over there. You can't say that the goy meant to be mevatel those leaves at all. Therefore, Rabbi Yossi can argue that the leaves are still also bahanah, and therefore they become mulch, they become fertilizer, and therefore the vegetables that grow from them are also mulch. Or at least you're not allowed to have that kind of hana, whatever. Whereas when it comes to the goy standing down the Avodah Zarah, the fact is he means to stand it down. It's not a normal thing of an
Avodah
Zarah. No, that's if he did it with Sarkah. We're talking about even if he did it with Sarkah, he did it to beautify the statue. But nevertheless, the fact is it's something that's a conscious act that he's doing, where previously these pieces of wood were part of it, and now they're not, and therefore you can argue that Bissel applies to the pieces that he sanded off.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, the Binyan Shlomo points out, we don't have, the Gemara didn't say over here, Ella. The Gemara didn't mention before the Hunna B'Rei Devashua. When the Gemara says Ella, it means never mind the earlier answers, we're going to give a new answer. What it means is the Hunna B'Rei Devashua is saying you need both. You need Ikra B'Rei Chachavim has to still be intact, and you need to have it's part of the natural growth cycle. Only then are we saying, only if you have those two criteria, are we going to say that something like the leaves or whatever is also. If it's not part of the natural growth cycle, like a goy standing it, or even if it is part of the natural growth cycle, but the ikker no longer exists, then you can argue that bissel would work, at least according to Rish Lakish. We're talking according to Rish Lakish. Okay. So now all this time Rabbi Yochanan has been asking on Rish Lakish. Now finally it's Rish Lakish's turn to ask Rabbi Yochanan. Well, so far we haven't contradicted Rish Lakish. So now Rish Lakish is going to try to contradict Rabbi Yochanan. Eisved of Shimon Lakish Lord Rabbi Yochanan. We learn in the Mishnah in Me'ilah, Cain Shabarosha Ilan Shal Hekdesh, if you find a nest on top of a tree that belongs to Hekdesh, so at one point you were Makdesh the tree, and now you find a nest on the top of it. The din is Loinanin V'Loinmoilin. You're not allowed to have Hanah from that nest, like you use the wood of it, Midrabanan. But if you did, then you haven't committed Me'ilah, because Midaraisa is not awesome.
You had a tree
which you donated that tree to Hekdesh.
Right.
Now you have, later on, you come and you find the nest that a bird built on top of it.
Right.
We're saying the nest, Me'ilah doesn't apply to Daraisa for reasons that we'll talk about soon. However, Midrabanan, you're not allowed to have Hanah from it.
But it's not
Me'ilah. Right. Berosha Shel Asherah, on the other hand, what happens in a parallel case? If there's an Asherah tree, which is also Bahanah, and then you find a nest on the top of it, Yakis Bekona, what you should do is knock down the nest. Knock down the nest using a stick. And then you can destroy the Asherah, and then you're able to have Hanah from the sticks that made up the nest. As opposed to, in other words, the point of knocking it off with a stick, Rashi says, means don't climb up the Asherah to get down the nest, because then you're benefiting from the Asherah, and you can't do that. Tosfos says, even if the nest is low down enough that you could actually reach it, nevertheless, you should still knock it down with a stick in order because of Maris Ayin. Otherwise, people are going to think that maybe you just broke pieces off the Asherah and now you're going
to
be using
it. Why do you have to destroy the nest? What's the
problem? No, you don't have to destroy the nest, but if you want to use the wood from the nest, if you want to burn it together with the tree, fine. But if you want the wood from the nest, then the way to do it is you knock it off.
You have to knock it off the stick,
right. Now, the point is, Kasaka Daitach, now, the assumption for purposes of Rish Lakish's question is, you're going to shovra memenu eisim v'kinsa behen, that what the nest is made out of wood that the bird took from the Asherah tree itself and made a nest. V'chatoni yatiz v'kona. And yet the Mishnah is saying that, you knock down the nest, and the nest remains musabana. Even though the bird did it, which is the equivalent of mishtabra mele, it's the equivalent of pieces breaking off the asherah spontaneously, and we're saying they're musabana.
Right.
So what you would be saying is also, what are you going to do with that mission? Why are you allowed to benefit from the nest? The answer is, oh, my skin is going to IC8 in my alma, the kinsa behen. You're right. Rabbi Yochanan would say, the case is, the Mishnah must be talking about a case where the bird brought the wood for the nest from a different tree, not necessarily from the same tree. So therefore, obviously, it's not part of the tree. Therefore, it's not also Bahana in and of itself. Now, the Rambam actually learns that it means that any nest that we find on top of an Asherah, we can assume the wood for it came from a different tree, because usually the Rambam says that's how birds do. They usually go all around the place from different trees or grass or whatever. The Ravid says only if you recognize that this wood is not from this tree. It's a different type of wood, let's say. It's an apple tree, and you see that the pieces are from a peach tree. So therefore, Sir Rabbi Yochanan would say that Mishnah is no proof against me, because if the wood came from the Asherah itself, the nest itself would be also, because we wouldn't say Bissel applies to it. But since, in this case, the wood comes from a different tree, no problem, the other tree's not an Asherah. In fact, the Gemara says, Zekanami. In fact,
even if it was placed on an Asherah.
So the fact that it was placed on the Asherah, wait, that's why we're saying you knock it off with a stick. The next itself doesn't become ulcer just because it was sitting on top of an Asherah. Okay. In fact, the Gemara says, Zekanami. You can, in fact, prove this from the wording of the Mishnah. Dikatani, Gabe Hektish, Lenyan, and Vele Merlin. Because look at the first part of the Mishnah, when it talks about Hektish, where it said you're not allowed to have Hanah from it, but Midrabban, but Mi'ilo doesn't apply to the next Daraisa. So, the Gemara says like this, Iyam Vishlema da Isi me Alma, if you say that the bird brought wood from some other tree and built its nest on top of this one, then we can understand why Lenyan and Vele Merlin. Lenyan and Midrabban, then we're saying you should not have Hanah from it. You should not have hanah from it midrabban, because if you have hanah from the nest, you may end up having hanah from the branches of the tree itself. So with an asherah, we say Jews usually will stay away from an asherah. They know it's avodah zarah. They know it's off limits. We're not worried that if you're allowed to, but if it's a hektish tree, okay, people are not necessarily so careful about hektish. Therefore, we may need to make a zera not to have hanah from the nest. But nevertheless, midaraisa, Merlin, midaraisa, the whole kaddish, Me'ila wouldn't apply daraisa because this wood was never hektish because it was never part of the tree. So if you understand it that way, then it's good. Eli, how much is shavra eisim imen of a kinsavan? But you, the shlokish, are trying to say that the case is that it came from the actual tree itself, and you're saying that in the case of an asherah, it'll still be mutabana. So why in the case of hektish, amayla Merlin, why would Me'ila not apply hokaddishi? The fact is, it should apply. This wood came from the tree itself. Yeah. The tree is hektish. The wood is hektish.
Yeah.
Well, no. The point is, in other words, we can't make a difference between daraisa and derabbana. If you're right. Yeah. Okay. So they're
same.
Right. So the Gemara answer is midi. Yeah. What makes you think that? What makes you think that's just a strong question? We could be talking about where these branches, these twigs grew after the tree was made hektish. The Tana of this Mishnah may hold, which is a machlokas in a few places in the Gemara, whether Mi'ila applies to what grows from the tree afterwards. If I declare a tree hektish, it comes up, according to Mithurat Hashas, the only previous place that we've discussed it in the Gemara is in Sochem, and that was a few years back, in connection with Anshe. Yeah, okay, we talked about in connection with Anshe Yericho, that there were certain things that they did that the Chacham didn't approve of, and one of them was that they would use branches of hektish trees. But yeah, one idea is, exactly, so it would be maktish the tree, later on new branches grow from it, they held in Me'ila B'Gidulin, therefore Me'ila doesn't apply. So Rish Lakish would answer that it doesn't matter, even if the bird took wood from the tree itself and built its nest, as long as this wood did not exist at the time the tree was declared hektish, as long as it grew afterwards, then we can say Me'ila doesn't apply to Daraisa. It only applies to Rabban. So therefore, fine, that fits very well with the first part of the Mishnah.
Right.
As far as the second part, about the Asherah, we're saying, again, Rish Lakish would say once branches are broken off it by the bird, they're bottled, and therefore you can have Anah from the nest. But so not necessarily, in other words, so fine. The halacha may well be like Rabbi Yochanan, which in the end it is, but we can't necessarily prove from this Mishnah Rabbi Yochanan's point, because the Mishnah could be, according to this opinion, Ein Merlin V'Gidulin.
That's the center of my focus.
Well, no, that's one way of looking at it, again. Okay. What about, fine, so all that is one answer. Rabbi Bohu gives another answer in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. I have another way of answering the Mishnah according to Rabbi Yochanan. You don't have to say that the wood came from a different tree. Maybe even the wood came from the same tree itself. So with an Asherah, therefore we understand. So the question is, why with an Asherah are you allowed to have Hanah from the nest? Because my yachis ba'afrechim. What does it mean, knock it down? It means if you want to have hanah from the birds, from the baby birds that are in the nest, then you need to knock down the nest. The nest itself, you can't use the nest itself. It'll be off the banah because the wood came from the tree. You can use the chicks. You can use the chicks that are inside it. But you can't climb up the tree to get them. Therefore, if you want to use them, you have to knock them down. Amalei Rav Yaakov l'Rav Yirmiyahu bar Techlifa. Asbrolach, that Rabbi Yaakov says to Rabbi Yirmiyahu bar Techlifa, I'll clarify, let me explain what the Mishnah would mean according to Rabbi Yochanan. Be'efreichin, we are talking about having Hanah from the Be'efreichin kan v'kan mutarin. If it's chicks that are in the nest, And either way, it would be mussar. If the tree was a hektish tree, the nest itself may be also because the branches came from the tree itself, but not the chicks. They wouldn't be also. And the same thing for Avodah Zarah. And the reason is because the chicks don't necessarily need the tree so much. I mean, they are baby birds. They are in the nest, but we don't say they're not so directly tied to the tree that we should after them along with the tree.
They need it to...
They need it in order to live in, fine, but it's not like, it's not, right. As opposed to the basin, kanvakana sturin. On the other hand, when it's eggs need the tree much more. They actually need to be in the nest. So therefore, the Rabbanon will make zera on them that they'll be also just as much as the tree itself.
On an egg. Not on a chick.
Not on, right. Tosfos gives another reason also.
I wouldn't know.
What do you mean, how would you know if you see eggs in there or if you see chicks in there?
No, but the chicks may come from the eggs.
Eventually, the eggs will hatch into chicks. We're talking about right now. You went and discovered that the Asherah has a nest on the top of it.
Right.
If there are eggs in it, then the eggs are going to be also b'hanah as well. When you destroy the Asherah, you have to destroy the eggs too, according to this answer. The chicks, you would not have to. And aside from the fact that the difference is that chicks need the tree less than eggs do, Tosfos gives another reason. When it comes to chicks, you're not likely to climb up the tree to get them because you have other ways of getting them out. You could knock down the nest and the chicks will get out of it safely. As opposed to, you're not going to do that with the eggs. You knock down the nest with eggs inside it, the eggs will break. Therefore, we have more reason to be concerned that you're going to climb up the tree to get the eggs, and the tree is also b'hanah because it's an asherah. So therefore, that's another reason to be gozer on eggs, not chicks. However, Ravashi says, even with chicks, if they're so small that they still need their mother, then they will also like eggs in the sense they still definitely need the nest. In other words, there are chicks that still, like they come back and forth to the nest. They don't live in it all the time. As opposed to
the mother is also...
No, but that's the thing. If they need their mother, then they're like eggs. Once they're at the point where they're already able to fly, they just return to the nest in the evenings or whatever. That we don't say they need them so much that we should be gozer on them. Okay, so the bottom line is that neither Rosh Lakish nor Rav Yechanan has been able to contradict the other, many of these Mishnayos or Braises or whatever. As usual, though, with Machlokas, Rosh Lakish and Rav Yechanan, as usual, the Halacha is like Rav Yechanan. And so therefore, if an Avodah Zarah breaks, if we know that it broke on its own, it will, and we know that it was worshipped, it will be also B'hanah. If we don't know whether it broke on its own, then we have more reason to be makel, because then it could have broken on its own, or it could be that a goy broke it. And that's why we have in Shulchan Aruch, we have the two different dinim. If you find it broken versus if you know that a goy broke it. If you find it broken versus if you know that it broke on its own.
Yeah.
Mishnah says, Hamoitzeh kelim v'aleihem tzuras chama, if somebody finds kelim, utensils, and on the utensil is drawn a picture of the sun. Now, what does it mean, a picture of the sun? It doesn't mean like a circle representing the sun. Because we're talking about over here, what we're going to deal... No. Because we're going to deal with the question, do they worship this picture that's on the cave? Now, if it's just a circle, even if it's got rays, they're not going to worship it. So Rashi doesn't say in so many words. Rashi just says, mazal chama v'chein levana, the Rambam spells out in more detail, like they had. And they had mythological representations of the sun and the moon and whatnot. The sun, for example, they would represent as a crowned king seated in a chariot. Venus, they would represent as a young girl, etc. So each one, they had its mythological representation. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about. So if you find, not just a picture of the sun, but rather the image that they use to represent like the mazel, to represent like the star of the sun.
Supernatural.
Yes. So v'alem tzuras chama, so you find on them this tzura of the sun, tzuras levana, or the moon, or tzuras drakon, or an image of a dragon, as we mentioned before. They lich in the Yamamelach, then you have to throw them into the Yamamelach because they're also behind. So first of all, Yamamelach could mean the Dead Sea, in which case the point is that way nobody will ever find it because no ships even go in the Dead Sea.
It's kind of the Dead Sea than in the Mediterranean.
No, why would it be easier to find it in the Dead Sea?
It's close.
It's dense enough, it's heavy enough, that whole thing. That's not the issue. But you have, for example, the Rambam many times uses the word Yamamelach to mean the Mediterranean. The Rambam uses the word Yamamelach to just mean any salty sea. So therefore, it could mean the Mediterranean also. The point is, you have to destroy it, you have to get rid of it in such a way that nobody's going to have an announcement. By the way, this stuff about a dragon, the Rambam points out an interesting detail. So the sun and the moon, we understand. Why, if it's a dragon of all things?
Yeah.
Mythologically, they had an idea whenever there's an eclipse that it's a dragon eating the sun or the moon. Therefore, they represented the path of the mazalos, the ecliptic, the path along which the sun moves in the sky. They represented it as a dragon, and therefore they would worship such an image.
And now they would appear again.
Yeah, and it's interesting actually. In Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, when the Rambam was dealing, the Rambam deals briefly with the Rambam doesn't deal directly there with eclipses, but indirectly because he talks about over there the path of the sun and the path of the moon and the two places and along the two places where they intersect, which is negeya for certain calculations in Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh. The Goyim in those days called those the head of the dragon and the tail of the dragon. The Rambam, who doesn't want to mention a dragon in that connection because of the Avodah Zarah connotation, he just calls them the head and the tail. Okay. Anyway, so that's the
kind of
comment. And it was Rav Shimon Gamliel, remember, Rav Shimon Gamliel says it depends what kind of keli we're talking about. Shalom Chubadin Asurin, if you find the image on an important type of keli, on an honorable type of keli, Asurin, then they're also, because then it's likely that they worship. Shalom uvuzin mutarin, but if it's on a cheap kind of keli, on something that's not that used for something that's used for dishonorable purposes or whatever, then it's mutar because then it's probably just for decoration. The Yerushalmi adds a further detail, by the way, which is also brought in Shulchan Aruch, even on a keli that's mechubad. If, for example, if you have, let's say, it's on a cup and it's below the water, it's below the water level, then it would also be mutar because they're not gonna worship it if it's made to be below the water level. That's the equivalent of it being mevuzin. Yeah. Okay, so the Gemara asks, are you telling me that only these three types of pictures that we mentioned in our Mishnah, the mazel of the sun, of the moon, and the dragon, are the only ones that they worship? They wouldn't worship any other kinds of pictures. Now, by the way, notice, in our Mishnah, we're not talking the previous Mishnayos, we're talking about slumim, which are freestanding images, statues. Here we're talking about pictures that are painted or engraved or whatever on the surface of a keli. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so you're telling me that those are the only kind of pictures or engravings that they would worship? Or to many, I have a contradiction. A Mishnah says in Cholin, if somebody shechts an animal, l'shum, and I go to add based on the Mishnah over there, l'shum horim, l'shum gvois, if a person shechts an animal, having in mind the mountains, meaning Rashi says the sar in charge of the mountains, there's a malach in charge of the mountains, or the hills, yam, l'shum yamim, in honor of the seas, l'shum nahores, the rivers, l'shum midbar, for the sar of the midbar, l'shum chama, l'shum levana, l'shum kechav mazolos, the sar of the sun or the moon, or the stars and planets, or the Shum Michal Saragodo, or in honor of Michal, the great star, the greatest creature that exists, the Shum Shilsh or Cotton, Michal, the Malach Michal. Or the Shum Shilsh.
They worship the Malach.
Yeah, they worship all kinds of Malachim, yeah. So, but here we're not talking about a goy, even we're talking about a yid shechts an animal, having in mind, or it could be, it's the same thing, really, whether a yid or a goy does it. Having in mind it's in honor of one of these things, or the other way around, the Shum Shilsh or Cotton, he does it in honor of a little worm, which is the opposite extreme as Michal.
Right.
The point is, in the word, that he shechted it in honor of one of these kinds of things, or in honor of one of their starim. Harel Zibche Mesim, the din is this considered a Zibche Mesim, it's a korban for Avodah Zarah, and it's also Bahana. It's Nevela, and it's also Bahana. So we see that they worship many different kinds of creatures. I'm going to buy a Mislachla called the Mashichi Palchi. Sure, to worship, of course, the goyim will worship whatever they find. So, the miflach, to worship, l'chol the mashkechi palsi, whatever they find that speaks to them, that they like, they'll worship. Neser or mafalchi, but to go to the point of drawing a picture and then worshiping it, tani tlosa de chashivi, only these three things which they consider important, the mazel of the sun and the moon and the dragon, only those will they actually draw a picture and in order to worship it, only of these three things.
So
but anything else that they might draw a picture of Michal or of a worm or what have you. That would just be we can assume they only did it for decoration, not necessarily to worship.
So if that's the case, why did Torah say that we're not allowed to draw anything under the sun?
First of all, hold on, it's not that we're not allowed to draw anything under the sun. We're going to actually start discussing it now, and we're going to discuss more tomorrow what exactly we are and aren't allowed to draw. We're going to get there. But no, of course, there are certain things you're unquestionably allowed to draw, even
okay.
In relief. Most kinds of animals, for example. There are certain things that you can't do in relief, but maybe you could do flat. There are other things that not even flat. We're going to get to in a little bit. We're going to start talking about it in our Gemara over here, and we'll continue more with the details about it tomorrow.
The stars and the sun.
So that's hold on. We'll deal with more tomorrow. That detail we'll deal more with tomorrow, whether you're allowed to draw pictures of the sun. Anyway, the point is, for our purposes, Abaye is saying, if you find a keli that had a picture of a mountain on it or a picture of a worm or what have you, there's no reason to assume they drew it in order to worship it. Because those kind of things, they don't bother drawing in order to worship. They draw them for decoration. But the model of the mythological representation of the sun or the moon or the dragon, that they would actually draw a picture of on an honorable type of keli in order to worship.
What about scientific pictures of the sun?
Again, tomorrow. Let's leave it for now because yeah. Okay. The Gemara says, Mankit Rav Sheshes Chumri Masni Yosa. Rav Sheshes used to gather together the Chumri of Mishnayos and Braises. Rashi explains that Chumri means the ones that are Chomer, the ones that are very hard to understand. The ones that are very hard to understand, that we need that this way he would gather them all together so they would discuss them in the Midrash and figure out how to understand them, how to reconcile them. Tosfos says that the word Chumri can also mean like a collection, like a necklace sort of, so like he would string together a bunch of Mishnayos and Braises and learn them together. Anyway, so he used to do that, Vatoni, and he taught the following Braises. Kol mazolis mutarin, all kinds of mazolis are allowed. Now, what do we mean by allowed? Do we mean you're allowed to draw them, or do we mean you're allowed to possess them? That's what we have to figure out. So all mazolis are mutar, chutz mi mazol chamer olavane, except for the mazol, the mythological representation of the sun and the moon. V'chol ha-partzufin mutarin, all kinds of faces of people, of animals, or what have you, are mutar, chutz mi partzuf olavane, except for a human face. And all kinds of pictures are mutter, all kinds of pictures of other objects in the world are mutter, chutz mitzuras drachtein, except for a picture of a dragon. That's what we have to figure out. What does he mean over here? Does he mean what you're allowed to draw and what you're not allowed to draw? Or does he mean what you're allowed to possess and what you're not allowed to possess? So that's why it's chumri masniyais there. It's difficult to understand, to reconcile them. So Omar, let's look at these braises and analyze them. Kol mazolis mutarin chutz mazol chama olavana. We're saying all mazolis are mutar except for the mazol of the sun and the moon. Mm-hmm. So the question is, hachav mayaskinen, what is the scenario over here? What are we talking about? To make them or to possess them? Ilema b'oise, are you going to say that the braise is saying you're allowed to make any mazol, you're allowed to make an image or a picture of any other mazol except for the mazol of the sun and the moon? Would you be allowed to do such a thing with any other mazel either? Vaktiv, you have a pasuk that says, Lois Sasun Iti. The pasuk says, don't make with me. And that means, Lois Sasun Kid Musham Moshai Hamasham Shinafon Abamorim. Don't make images of, Hashem says, of my servants that serve before me in the heavens. So therefore, not only you wouldn't be allowed to make an image of the sun or the moon or the mythological representation, also of the galaxies and the stars and the mythological representations of any of the other planets, etc. Yeah. So it can't mean that. Elof shittu b'moise. Evidently, then, that part of the bride, that has to be talking about a case where you found a keli that has one of these representations. Like we said in our mission. No, that's why I write Sasun, but we're saying that when the Braisa starts by saying, all mazolis are mutter, except for the mazol of the sun and the moon, obviously that part must be, if you found a keli that has some other representation of a mazol on it, you're allowed to keep it, but not the sun, as opposed to the mazol of the sun and the moon, right? As we learned in our mission, if you find kalim that have on them the image, the mythological image of the sun or the moon or the dragon, you're lichim the yamamalach, then you have to throw them into the yamamalach because they're also bana. But if you found on there, for example, of the representation, let's say, of Venus or Mars or what have you, then you would be allowed to keep it. Fine. So if that's what that part of the braisa means, even Moise, if you're going to tell me then that this collection of braises is talking about a case where you found Kalim with these representations, what about Eimam Tziyosa? Look at the second part of the braisa where it said Kol Hapartzufis Mutarin Chutz Mipartzuf of Adam, that we said all kinds of faces you're allowed to keep, except for human faces.
Right.
No, even Moise, Partzuf Adam Miyoter. If you find a Kalim with a person's face on it, is it also to keep? We said in the Mishnah only if you find on them an image of the sun or the moon or the dragon, do you have to throw them into the Yamamelach? So only if it's a picture of a dragon, but not a picture of a person's face. So if you find a keli with a person's face on it, based on our Mishnah, you should be allowed to keep it. We wouldn't assume that it was made for Avodah Zarah. We would assume it was made for decoration.
Yeah, because we only mentioned the moon.
Because we only mentioned the sun, moon, and the dragon. Elof shitcha ba'oisa. So obviously that second part of the bright, that has to be talking about a case where a person made a picture. And that would be also to make a picture of a person's face. V'chidrav Huna Bredi of Yeshua, like Rav Huna Bredi of Yeshua says later on, we're going to learn tomorrow, that he says that the pasuk that we quoted before, Loi Sasun Iti, besides the meaning that we said before, that you're not allowed to make images of the things that serve Hashem up in the heavens, like the sun and the moon and whatnot, and then the stars and planets, another meaning of Loi Sasun Iti means don't make something that is like my likeness. A person is made in Tzelem Elokim. Therefore, from that pasuk, we also learn you're not allowed to make a representation of a human face. So fine.
Not the Gashmius. I mean, no. The Abish says
that's fine, obviously. But the fact that the Torah describes a person, the fact that the Torah describes a human being as Tzelem Elokim, means, therefore, in a certain sense, there's a certain similarity.
Spiritually,
there's a certain similarity between a human being and Hashem.
Doesn't mean a face. Or
no, obviously, it doesn't mean a physical. But nevertheless, the point is, when the prophet says Loi Sasun Iti, is also Loi Sasun Oisi. Don't make something that could be taken as similar to a representation of me, meaning a human being's face. And in fact, yeah, for example, I mean, the Navi Yechezkel, when he described the Maisa Merkava, he described that, after he described the Chayas HaKodesh, and the Isanim and whatever, that hold up the Merkava, he says, so to speak, that I saw a throne, and I saw on it the likeness of a person sitting on the throne. So therefore, in a certain sense, Hashem can be compared to the thing. Okay. Anyway, so the point is, so fine, that in that case, that second part of the Braisa, so far what we have is the first part of the Braisa that mentions that all mazalos are mutter except for the sun and the moon. That has to be talking about when you found it, because to make it, any of them would be author. On the other hand, the second part about the faces, where it says that only a face of a person is author, that must be talking about making them, right? So then let's look at the third part. Iba oisef, so if you're going to say that it's talking about making them, ema seif, so look at the next part of the Braisa. We say that all kinds of images of items in the world are mutter except for a picture of a dragon. Why would making a picture of a dragon be author if you're not making it to worship? The pasuk says you're not allowed to make with me, meaning anything that serves Hashem in the heavens, or a human being, gods of silver or gods of gold, implying, and again, only the things that serve Hashem in the heavens, Hani'in, Surah, Zrach, and Loi. You're not allowed to make a picture of the sun or the moon or what have you, but you're allowed to make a picture of a dragon. Yeah, the Goyim came up with this mythological idea that a dragon eats up the sun or the moon, and therefore they picture that there's a dragon up in the heavens. But there isn't one there, actually. So therefore, why would a dragon, if a dragon is not going to serve Hashem in the heavens, therefore it shouldn't be Asur. Obviously, that part of the Braisa must be talking again where you found a keli with a picture of a dragon on it. And again, back to our Mishnah, you said if you find a keli with a picture of the mythological representation of the sun or moon or the dragon, then you have to get rid of it. The problem with that is now we understand why Rav Sheshet brought these three Braises together in order for us to figure out what's going on over here. Are you going to tell me the first case of the Braita is talking about where you find a keli? The second one is talking about what you're allowed to make a picture of. And the third one is back to what you find? It doesn't make sense. Yeah. I'm going to buy it. Somebody says, yeah, hey. Reisha v'seifah b'moitzeh m'siyasa b'oitzeh. Sure, it could be that the Braita is like that. Because these Braises weren't necessarily all taught together. These Braises, Rav Sheshet put together these Braises because they all have a certain superficial similarity between them. They all mention a case. All blank is also except for blank. But they don't have to all be talking about the same case. Some of them could be talking about making them. Some of them could be talking about finding them. Abai doesn't have a problem with that. Rava on the call of a moat. So Rava says you don't have to answer that. You could say all three cases are talking about where you found it. So what are you going to do about what we said, that if you find that anything is also except for a picture of a person? So and we said, what would that mean? And why would a picture of a person be author if our Mishnah only mentioned a picture of the sun, the moon, or a dragon? Because, we could answer the case involving the picture of the person is according to Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanya, as we learn in the Braisa, Rabbi Yehuda adds to the list in our Mishnah, besides the sun, the moon, and the dragon, he adds also, Ahdmus Menika Vesar Afis.
What's that?
He also adds, also if there's a picture of a Menika, a nursing woman, or the Sar Apis, which is the name of a certain Geshke that they worshipped in those days. You can find in Goyisha histories and whatnot, there was an idol called Serapis that they worshipped in Egypt.
Why
and eventually... Well, hold on. Minika, why would they worship an image of a nursing woman? Al Shem Chava, Shem Minika, Kol Olam Kula. It was meant as a representation of Chava, who nursed the whole world, because she's the mother of all human beings that ever existed. So therefore, when you have a picture of a nursing woman, it's meant to represent her, that they deified her and made her into a getchka. And therefore, Rabbi Huda says, not only would they make three-dimensional, freestanding images of her, but they would also draw pictures of her on a keli and worship that. Therefore, so now we can understand. When the Braitha said any picture on a keli is mutter unless it's a picture of a person, we don't mean any old person. We mean a picture of this menechet, of this nursing woman. What's the star apis? What does that represent? Al Shem Yosef. That was meant as a representation of Yosef, where again they made a god out of him. Why is he called star apis? Shesar umefis is kala olam kolay. Because he's star and mefis the whole world. So Rashi explains Sar as Meloshin Sar. He was a leader, right? like Sar with a sin. Behafis, and he appeased, he calmed down the whole world, because the whole world was worried about the famine in his time, and he calmed them down by making grain available to them. So therefore, later on, the Egyptians and eventually everybody else deified him, and then started worshiping a representation of him as a god. Well, eventually, Asher lo yada, that's Yosef. Yeah, right. Tosfos gives a different...
Next generation.
Yeah, okay.
A few generations.
Yeah, a few generations. Tosfos gives another explanation also. Another, the sor might be... sor ofes, the word sor can also mean looking into. And we see some Gemaras where it's used that way. Ofes is Meloshin, like the Pasuk says, the ofes kosef, where the Mitzrayim come to Yosef and say, you got to provide us with grain because we're out of money and we're out of animals. And therefore, he ends up buying them as servants to Pare, etc. So therefore, sor ofes, it's like they told Yosef, take a look, there's nothing left. And therefore, they
or
came up
with like nothing.
Well, no, they're telling him there's nothing left. We already used up all the stock of grain that we have to buy up. Yeah. So therefore, so they nicknamed him Star Ephes. Look, there's nothing. Rabbi Akademden also points out yet another thing. The word Ephes, of course, also means nothing. So therefore, it's also, as usual, we try to call other disorders by derogatory names.
Right.
Therefore, instead of calling it Star Ephes, like the Goyim call him, we call him Star Ephes, the master of nothing. So therefore, so those are the kinds of things. Rabbi Yehuda is saying, you find a picture of this Menicha or of Seraphis, then that's also something that they worship even when it's just a picture on a case.
Is that the halacha?
Well, again, like we said the other day, it really depends what the Goyim worship at a particular time.
But when you find a woman nursing, I mean...
So nowadays, they don't necessarily worship such things. In fact, the Amar deals with the question, nowadays they don't worship such things. They don't worship a mythological representation of the sun or the moon either. But not necessarily is it also. The Shach discusses at some length of it. Yosef has a whole discussion about whether
only
it might...
Only when they worship it that it's usher?
Yeah, only in a time and place where they worship such things, yeah. So the Beis Yosef wants to say that nevertheless we should be machmer, and that Amal brings it, that Amal brings it in Shulchan Aruch, and the Shach has a very hard time understanding why to be machmer on it if nobody worships such things now. Anyway, so just to finish off over here. Okay. Now, when Rabbi Huda says that an image of Seraphis is Osir, doesn't just mean any old picture that people might claim is Seraphis, only if it's holding a griva, which is a measure, a container used for measuring grain, the kokayo, and you can see in the picture that he's measuring out grain. Then it's meant as representation of Yosef, who measured out grain to the people. Otherwise not. Otherwise, it's not a picture of a person. And Vahu...
Measuring grain?
Yeah, in other words, because that's the symbolism of Yosef. If they're worshipping Seraphis, which represents Yosef, then they're representing him mythologically as a person holding a measure to measure out grain, because that's what Yosef did for the people. Otherwise, it's not a Seraphis. Vahu did not to then become a Nika. And as far as the Menika, what's the definition? Not just any old picture of a woman. It means Davka if she's depicted holding a baby and nursing it. That's the Menicha that Rabbi Huda is saying is author because they worship it even if it's drawn on a
case. Today would be okay.
Today, that's the point. That's the point. On the face of it should be mutter because nobody worships it. On the other hand, that Amar brings opinions that maybe it still would be. And again, the Shach discusses all the pros and cons. Why indeed should it be author? Anyway, the point is returning to Rav Sheshes' collection of three braises. So now we understand, therefore, says Rava, you don't have to say that some of them are talking about a keli that you found and some of them are talking about what you're allowed to make. All of them are talking about what you found. The first one about all mazolos is the mutter except for the mazal of Chama and Levana, that fits with our Mishnah. The second one about any parasuk, any image of a human, any image of a face of a creature is mutter unless it's the face of a person. That would be a point of the Yehuda, specifically if it's a face of Seraphis or a face of Menicha. And the third one that says that any type of picture is mutter except for a picture of a dragon, that again fits with our Mishnah. That picture of a dragon on a keli would make it also. So therefore, so all three of them are talking about where you found them. The braises, therefore, are not addressing the question of what kind of pictures you're allowed to make and what kind you're not allowed to make. That we're going to deal with later. That we're going
to
do.
When you find even today, that would apply?
So again, that then you get into the question. Again, that's the question. That's the question. Whether no, not whether it's used. Well, first of all, there was the question whether it's used as Avodah Zarah. But nowadays, it's more the question, given that nowadays none of the Goyim use such things as Avodah Zarah, is it still also or not? On the face of it, it should be mutter. But again, the Ramah brings opinions that nevertheless you should be machmer in it. And the Shach discusses at some length
why
what's the logic? Why should that be
so? Between the Ramah and the Shach, what's the...
We don't have a higher opinion to appeal to. So the fact is that the Ramah says there are those who are machmer on it. So therefore, you might have to be machmer on it. If you have an actual case like that, it's something you got to ask the Rav, whether in practice we follow the Ramah or whether in practice we follow the Shach. In general, yes, but the Shach is the Shach is an acronym just like the Ramah.
What do they do?
So the Ramah is actually basing himself on something that's discussed in Beis Yosef or with a Sfaradi, but I don't know what they do.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll continue tomorrow night, Beis Hashem.